Good evening and welcome to this afternoon's program hosted by the Commonwealth Club Silicon Valley. My name is Angie Cuero. It is my pleasure to introduce Anna Quinlan, author of Still Life with Breadcrumbs. Anna began her journalism career at the age of 18 as a copy girl and later worked as a reporter for the New York Post and New York Times. While at the time she became only the third woman in the paper's history to write for its influential op-ed page, and in 1992 won the Pulitzer Prize for commentary for her nationally syndicated column Public and Private. In 1999, Anna joined Newsweek magazine as contributing editor and spent 10 years as the columnist for The Last Word. Her books and novels have garnered both critical and commercial success with her dynamic wit and her poignant writing style. Anna was the first writer ever to have books appear on fiction, nonfiction, and self-help New York Times bestseller lists. She graduated from Barnard College and was named one of the top 100 outstanding journalists in the U.S. of the last 100 years. She serves on the board of the Planned Parenthood Federation of America, and she is an American Academy of Arts and Sciences Fellow. Ladies and gentlemen, please join me in welcoming Anna Quinlan. It's lovely to be with you.
Thanks. Hey, Angie.
Hi. Still Life with Breadcrumbs. It's a novel that, like so many of your others, would be easy to say, oh, well, this is Anna Quinlan writing about so many aspects of herself. We have a woman who's roughly your age, has a celebrity profile, and presumably different from you, she is in desperate economic straits and is giving up her life that she has in New York and the celebrity therewith to go figure it all out in the backwoods, out in the boonies. It was interesting to me reading so much about what you had to say about that novel and what you've said about your own writing process. It was fascinating to me that you talked about one of your characters, who is the gentleman that she meets and eventually forms a relationship with, and you said, he's such a cliche, but the guy is the salt of the earth. And I wondered how much that said about your writing adventures, that you looked at forming a story about a very interesting woman, looked at bringing her a partner, and said, let's run the risk of making him a cliche. I'd just like to know your thought process behind that.
Oh, that's a really interesting question. I think one of the things that you're always looking for when you write a novel is that sense of where the drama comes from. And as I've said more than once, I was very resistant to the notion of plot when I first began writing novels, which might have argued that I should be doing something else. But I think I was resistant to the notion of machine-made plot, that idea of something that was jerry-built by the writer. And eventually I realized that, of course, plot is all around us in the way people bump up against each other. And I just was really intrigued by the idea of Rebecca Winter, this woman who had grown up in New York, who had become part of the arts community, who had been married to a British academic, who to some extent, and I say this with great love for New York City, where I live, but it's true nonetheless, to some extent was living among the most constant sort of artifice. To suddenly be in a situation in which she encountered someone and spent a lot of time with him and realized that artifice was completely absent from both his character and his life, and how she would deal with that and how they would deal with one another. I mean, it was the ultimate sort of when opposites attract.
I don't want to give too much away, and I'm going to risk that. I'm going to ride a fine line here. There, as the situation develops over the course of the book, there comes a very important miscommunication with them. She lacks information as to why he has acted the way he has. And she sits in her house and doesn't pick up the phone and doesn't make an effort to say, why did you do what you did? Was there a little bit of city versus country there? Was there a little bit about the insular quality of being in the city? Was that her or was that just Rebecca herself?
Actually, I think it had a lot more to do with the quality of male versus female. I mean, their relationship at that point is not at the point where she feels like she can say, hey, dude, what's up with you? She's not that kind of person anyhow. She's very reserved. She's been very emotionally battered by her marriage. She's really emotionally battered by the conditions of her life at this moment in time. And so she's not someone who is going to reveal herself in the way it takes to call someone and say, I thought we were friends, why haven't I seen you? And I think that owes more to her character and to the differences in the way men and women sometimes deal with each other than it does to the rural-urban dichotomy.
It's funny you bring up the male-female dichotomy, because there were two reviews of the book that really struck me. One was, if memory serves, New York Times, and she talked about the profundity disguised as such a simple love story. And there was a male who reviewed it for the Sacramento Bee and talked about how it was, you finally wrote something very simple, and he didn't say surface, but it's almost like he missed everything the female reviewer got.
Uh-huh.
Were you surprised by that?
I don't read reviews, so I have no idea what the bad ones say, and I have no idea what the good ones say. The impression I get from my closest friend, who is a book reviewer and who vets all my reviews.
She means Janet Maslin.
That's who I mean. Is that these are probably the best reviews of my career, pretty much across the board. But what I found is I don't learn anything from them. I don't learn anything that I can use as I move forward. Too often reviewers review me or what they think of my life rather than the work that's out there. I remember my last novel was a novel called Every Last One, and I was very pleased with how it turned out when I finished it, and I said to the editor-in-chief at Random House, Gina Santrello, if we published this under a pen name, it would get completely different kinds of reviews than under my name. And she said, yes, but it would sell 200,000 fewer copies. And so I had to agree with her that there's an upside to having a certain kind of reputation in the world. But there can be a downside to it, too. And when I stopped reading reviews, which was 3 books ago, I found it really, really liberating, because while I frequently cannot remember my cell phone number, I can remember every word of every review I've ever read. And even when they're good, if someone praises a technique that you use in a novel, and you're already working on a new novel and not using that technique at all, suddenly there's that little backstopping voice in your mind that says, oh, but that was so good last time, so you don't want any of the backstopping voices. The only voices you want in your head when you're writing a novel are the voices of your characters.
It's interesting you talk about changing your style or your technique from novel to novel or piece to piece, because way back in 2007, the Chicago Trib was talking about you and talking about how you avoid this voice of God, you know, that there's a much grittier empathy with your protagonists. In this book, there is a God or an omnipotent hanging somewhere behind the dialogue, and there's a key phrase that always comes up, but that was later.
Right.
Here's the evolution, but that was later. And another place that omnipotent person shows up is the parenthetical conclusion to stories that Rebecca will never find out. Mm-hmm. We see her interact with people. We see Rebecca's conclusion, mental conclusion from that moment. And then here comes that parenthetical moderator and says, well, here's what really happened to that hairdresser.
Okay, I've got to stop and say something. This is the most incisive reading of this novel of any person who has interviewed me. This is amazing to me, because everything you're talking about was so intentional. There were a couple of different layers of it. One was that I love conventional novels. I write conventional novels. But at a certain point, as I started to approach this material, I realized that I'm a little out of patience with how we write a conventional novel. And that is with the notion that everything sort of works together. That you introduce a character and she speaks and you watch her act, and then there's a paragraph of backstory that tells you something you need to know about her. And then she speaks some more, and then she goes into the kitchen, and then there's another paragraph of backstory. And I thought, I know this is going to sound so crazy, but I went out to a restaurant here in San Francisco with my sister a couple of years ago where they deconstructed some dish. I can't remember what it was, but a dish that would normally be all of a piece had been separated into its component parts. And I kept thinking about that and thinking, that's the novel I want to write. I want to write a novel where some chapters are forward action. And some chapters are completely backstory, a chapter that begins, this is what happened before. And I want to be bold-faced about that. I don't want to, like, ease into it. I want to say, this is what happened before this, or something like that. And one chapter will be a wedding announcement that tells you about these two people who are now divorced, that sort of thing. I wanted to deconstruct the ways in which I'd written a novel before. And really, I realized that the only way to do that was to take a third-person kind of voice of God approach. Because if you're writing in the first person, as I did, for example, in Black and Blue, because the kind of immediacy and heat of the material demanded that you be with your protagonist in that way, then the story has to be seamless. It has to flow in that way where the backstory and the front story merge. But in that voice of God universe, you could separate things out into their component parts, and that's really what I wanted to do with this book.
Does that too give you more room to perhaps, I don't want to use the word judge because that's so negative, does that give you more room to examine your protagonist for the reader in ways that Rebecca wouldn't examine herself?
Absolutely, and it gives you more room to comment on the action. I mean, Fran Flynn, who is fleeing from her cop husband who abuses her and trying to set up a new life for herself, is not by temperament, background or inclination going to comment in certain ways on the action of the novel. The third person omniscient narrator in Still Life with Breadcrumbs, whoever he or she may be, can step back and sort of pass judgment on the action of the piece in a way that you just can't with another kind of narrator.
You've got such a backlog of work now. You have such a catalog. This is your 18th book. I wonder if, as an author, there are things that your people, your agent, your publisher, are willing to risk with you that maybe they would not. I think of someone in Hollywood trying to make a movie about a 60-year-old woman and exactly how far that would get. How much of your success with being able to put these things forward has to do with the fact that you're Anna Quinlan and you've got a success record? How would a new person, do with putting out a book like this?
I don't really know the answer to that. I mean, I've sort of zigged and zagged on subject matter with my publisher, and I've had the same publisher and editor all along, Kate Medina at Random House. And there never seems to have been a moment where she sort of thought, okay, this isn't quite working. And of course, there's a 60-year-old protagonist in this novel, but in Blessings, which was 2-3 books ago, there was an 80-year-old protagonist. So they haven't seemed to balk at anything, and I don't know how much that's because they feel that they can rely upon my audience to support me and take a chance that I'll develop a new audience at the same time.
Can we talk about the changes you've seen in the publishing industry over time? I'm acquainted with a number of authors, and one of the themes that comes up so often is how much support a publishing house can give you, not how much they choose to give you, but granted today's fiscal realities, will they actually copy edit every page? Will they actually do a full editing job and talk to you about placement of bits of plot and what becomes of the characters? Has that changed for you over the years?
Oh, my gosh. You're hitting on one of my both favorite and least favorite subjects, which is I began in 1988. I had a collection of my Life in the 30s columns called Living Out Loud and 50 pages of my first novel to sell together. And so my agent arranged what is called an auction, which makes you feel like a piece of furniture. And different publishing houses say, okay, we're going to participate in the auction. It's all done by phone, unfortunately. When I first heard about it, I pictured this room full of people with paddles. So I met with three different editors. They all happened to be women. They were all with fantastic publishing houses. And I said the same thing to each one, which is, I really want to be edited. And in each case, they looked gobsmacked by that, because the writer who thinks that their work has been handed down on tablets from Mount Sinai is large. But I kept saying, I can't tell you how terrible it would be for me if 10 years out I reread my first novel and thought, this would have been really good if I'd just given it one more go at the typewriter. And so we had the auction. I wound up with Kate. And what we basically do, and the change has been obviously that I've gotten better at this, one would hope. But what we basically do is I finish a first draft. I give it to her. I used to give it to her on paper. She still reads it on paper, but I have taken a vow of a kind of text civil disobedience, which is, Kate, I'm not giving you paper anymore. Paper is over. I'm sending you this manuscript as an email. And then she has her assistant print it out on paper. And she takes about 2 weeks and usually reads it twice. And what I get back is I get three things back. A heavily annotated manuscript, a overview piece, single spaced, probably about 8 to 10 pages, that goes through the big muscle stuff. I really love this. I love Rebecca. I love Jim Bates. The opening is very strong, but that second paragraph, that second chapter, you lose me a little bit. Then when we get to the third chapter, I felt a little lost. Can you refer back to it? Then there's about a 25 or 30 page thing that breaks it down chapter by chapter. On page 8, you mention someone. I don't know who that is, so on and so forth. So what happens is this comes by FedEx, and I put it up in my office, and then I avoid it for about a week. Because I feel like if I avoid it, magically Kate will call me and go, you know, I've been thinking about my edits, and I think the first draft is perfect just the way it is. So then I avoid it for about a week, and then I open it, and I read the first thing and the second thing really, really quickly, and then I have what my children used to refer to as my Farrar Straus moment, because I'm a Random House writer. And it goes like this. Farrar Straus has always really liked my work. They would take me in a heartbeat. And they might understand me better then. And then I avoid it for 2 or 3 more days. And then one day, if the wind is in the east and I've had a good breakfast, I sit down at the computer and I read it all over. And then I start to implement about 60%. Of what Kate says. About 40% I decide she's just wrong about. She's just, you know, I'm doing something that's not so within her wheelhouse, maybe, so she doesn't get it, or she just wants me to go in a direction that I'm just not going to go. But I would say I do probably about 60%. Then it goes back to her, and sometimes I need to do a third go-round, too, because I've added new material or moved stuff around, and there's a little bit of smoothing she thinks needs to be done. Then I get a really serious copy edit, and boy, are they, I cannot say this enough, they are so good. They are so good. The number of times they've saved me from myself, the zenith of the form, Rise and Shine. I have two people in a cab. They're going uptown on Fifth Avenue. Now, if a cab goes uptown on Fifth Avenue, what you have is not a conversation. You have a massive collision. I mean, when they say, I just thought I would have had to live with that for the rest of my life. I would have been getting, you know, people would be in summer houses 15 years from now and read Rise and Shine and say, I've got to write to Anna Quinlan about this. And then they bounce it back to me. And then they say, here's the first pages. You should do one more read through. And I can't bear it at that point. I can't bear to read my own work anyhow, but I really can't bear it at that point. So my last line of defense is a fabulous, meticulous reader and crack grammarian whose name is Quinn Crovaton, who is my oldest child. And he does my final, he's done my final pass for my last three books. He always finds things. He really has a great eye. And then I'm done. But so as you can see, the next time you hear the books don't get edited, oh my God. It goes through the ringer. And the only reason I don't throw up my hands and say no mas is because it's always better. It's always better. And frankly, I'm at the point in my career where I could say the first draft is the last draft. And you know what? If I did that, I would be the most foolish writer on the face of the earth, because the first draft would be somewhere between adequate and good, but it wouldn't be good the way I want it to be good.
Mm-hmm. I'm just dwelling on that. When you go through that editing process, you mentioned that you don't always like to read your own words, and you emphasize, sure, by the end of the process, but you sound like you're not all that keen on reading your own work anyway. What's going on there with that?
I always see the mote in the eye. I mean, I really hate to reread my own work. I mean, people say to me all the time, when you reread one true thing, does this, and I'm like, I have not set eyes on one true thing in probably 15 or 20, I don't know how long it's been. I'm just always keenly aware of what's not quite good enough. You know, I'm very critical of myself. And so I just don't revisit it. And the great moments are, where was I? Oh, I think I was at City Arts and Lectures, and the person who was interviewing me gave me a column that I'd written about being homeless. I think it was in the 80s or 90s, and said, would you just read these five paragraphs aloud? And I got to the end, and I stopped, and I said, this is really good. And it was such a great moment for me, because I so rarely feel that way. And every once in a while, I'm forced to revisit my work, and I have to acknowledge that I did what I set out to do. But it can be really painful for me.
I like that you said that about your work as a columnist. This is a quote from you about this book, but you said, this book was a meditation on the nature of art. I hadn't considered it might be a meditation on my art. The world had been a lot more difficult with that transition than I did. For two books, I was called a columnist turned novelist. Then I was a columnist and novelist. Now I'm finally a novelist. Of course, that's what I've been to myself all along. I found that really interesting, because it's great that you're a novelist, but you were a columnist, and a damn good columnist. What do you mean you were a novelist all along?
Well, my goal from the very beginning was to be a novelist. When I was a little girl, I went to the public library, and I figured out where my novel would fall. It would fall between Proust and Ayn Rand. And I really wanted to do that. I thought the idea, I mean, I loved reading so much that I thought creating something between hardcovers that someone would check out of the library and want to read, I mean, what could be a better way to earn a living? But I got sidetracked by the newspaper business. And I got sidetracked by it, not for the original reason I did it, which was to earn a living, but because there may be other ways to earn a living that are better, but I don't know any of them. I mean, being a reporter for me was like nirvana. I got to go to all these places I would never have gotten to go. I got to ask people rude questions as a condition of my employment. I mean, I just loved it so much. But there was this skepticism about the ability to change. You know, nobody, you know, somebody is a crack eighth grade teacher, which is one of the two or three hardest jobs on the face of the earth. And then they decide to go, let's say, to law school and become a lawyer. And nobody says, well, you know, if you're a teacher, you can't become a lawyer. But there's a sense that if you're a journalist grounded in facts, you can't become a novelist grounded in fiction. And I just, first of all, I don't think that's true. Second of all, I always like to say that Dickens was a reporter, and Pete Dexter was a reporter, and Carl Hyacin is still kind of a reporter, and Michael Connelly and Laura Lippman, and, you know, when you're a reporter, you learn a lot about who people are and how they work. And for some reporters, that means that they're fabulous journalists, and for some it means that they feel drawn to enlarge the canvas through fiction. And that's what I did, and so making that transition successfully felt like a kind of victory. Make no mistake about it, Angie. I loved being a columnist. I'm really proud of the columns I wrote. I really felt in a way that is so satisfying that there were columns that I did good with. And, you know, in journalism, you don't get to feel that very much. But when something would change or people would change their minds about an issue, you know, that was fantastic. So I'm really proud of having done it, but I do something else now.
That's the issue of we all do this as human beings. We want people to stay in boxes. As you were talking, I grew up as the biggest David Bowie fan in the history of the world. But David Bowie got a role in The Elephant Man. And as someone who studied act my whole life, I was infuriated. How dare he? He was a rock and roller. I was an actor. And, of course, I went to see him, and I was completely blown away. But here you have Rebecca in your novel, who is a celebrated photographer known for a specific series of photographs. And Rebecca's dealing with having been in that box. She's known for that. It's past. It's aged. She's trying to find out who she is now, and she's still trying to do that with photography. Can she do something different with her photography? So, again, we go back to the boxes.
Well, and also she has another challenge, which is in a way that I think is true of many artists, what she does and has done is deeply intuitive. So she's not even sure how she made the photos that became this thing, you know, the poster and the greeting cards and so on and so forth. She took these photos of her kitchen counter when she was absolutely exhausted, and suddenly she's hailed as a feminist icon. And, you know, on the one hand, she rides that in terms of fame and fortune. On the other hand, there's this part of her brain that thinks, that wasn't what I was doing when I took out the camera, but here we are. You know, being in that box because of how other people see you as opposed to what your intention was.
So now we got shades of the imposter syndrome, too.
You know, when people really bust out of the box, this is such a digression, but I've got to make it because I've been thinking about it so much. So my psychological crush right now, not physical, despite his appearance, is Matthew McConaughey. Because here's a guy who was doing movies like How to Lose a Guy in 10 Days, which must have been torture for him. And clearly at a certain point he said, okay, I'm in this box. I'm a handsome leading man who looks great with my shirt off. Except that's not really who I am. And he turns around, and he's in the Dallas Buyers Club, and in True Detective, and in The Wolf, with these incredible performances. I mean, his performance in the Dallas Buyers Club is mesmerizing. It's as good as acting gets. And I think this is people are calling it the McConaissance, which I love. I wish I'd thought of that. But I just really admire someone who is doing work for which they're getting a lot of approbation and, in his case, plenty of money, and who wakes up one morning and says, you know, this is not who I am or want to be, and I'm going to take a different road. And he's someone who's doing it so flagrantly at this moment that I've been dwelling on him.
When I mentioned to people that I would be interviewing you, to a person, they mentioned that you walked away from your media work to go raise a family. And that still seems, I mean, all these years later, that still seems to be one of the first things people associate with you. So this is our theme for the afternoon, apparently, is breaking out of your prescribed box.
Well, but here's a really important fact to insert into our discussion. That doesn't happen to be true.
I'm going to go back and tell them all that.
That doesn't happen to be true. I mean, I was deputy metro editor. I had one little boy. I took 6 months off. I came back. When that little boy was 18 months old, I had a second little boy. I quit. And to keep me in the house, the executive editor invented a column called Life in the 30s, which we both thought was going to be a kind of a once-a-week placeholder, and instead blew up kaboom. So that when I finally did leave the paper in 1995, it was to be a full-time fiction writer because I only worked at home and around my kids' school schedules by then. I could not spend any more time with them or I was just going to lock myself in the bathroom. But when women give up power and influence, or what the world sees as power and influence, because I didn't think I was giving up anything. I had a great book contract. But when women give up so-called power and influence, the world assumes it's family-oriented. It doesn't assume that you decided to go down a different professional road. It assumes that it's all about your kids. I can absolutely, positively tell you, and I don't think this is going to happen, but if Hillary says, you know, I'm not running in 2016, somebody's going to say it's because Bill didn't want her to, and somebody's going to say it's because she wants to spend time with Chelsea's kids, if Chelsea is pregnant or is having kids. It won't be because she says to herself, this is not an effective way to affect change in this country anymore because the members of Congress of the opposite party are only interested in your personal destruction and not in serving the people of the United States.
On that topic, Mitt Romney emerged from nowhere, wherever his garage is these days. Mitt Romney emerged to say that Hillary shouldn't run because of Bill Clinton and Monica Lewinsky. I didn't follow that past the second paragraph because it was so absurd. But it struck me as interesting that the philandering, if it were, of the husband is reflected on the woman's viability as a candidate.
Which will only widen the voting gender gap that the Republicans suffered in 2012, believe me. I mean, I hear that all the time. People say to me, well, you know, and if she'll run, even though, you know, Bill will be hanging around. And I think this is, and I've met her first in 1991 when I wrote a column about her, when her husband was a distant third running for president. This is, without a doubt, the smartest, strongest, most capable woman, and perhaps smartest, strongest, most capable human being I have ever met in my whole life. The idea that Bill gets to hang around or that she has no control over Bill, if you knew her, the entire scenario is preposterous on its face, and if you know strong, smart women, it's deeply, deeply insulting. But come on, this is the same party where Mike Huckabee said women want Uncle Sugar to underwrite their libido by actually using prescription plans to pay for their prescriptions, which happen to be for oral contraceptives. They seem to keep missing the boat where we're concerned, and it makes me wonder, you know, who they're talking to. And by the way, on the Mitt Romney front, a Republican operative I know said to me last week, because their field seems to be so bereft at this point, you know, I keep hearing Mitt's going to run again. And I was like,
For our radio audience, that was the face of ecstasy.
Oh, gosh, I forgot about that.
Well, it gets even more complicated when you add the layer of race, because the coverage of Michelle Obama and her purported relationship with her husband, she's the angry black woman, Obama lives in fear of her, she's taking over the White House. All the layers that come through again and again, always centered first on the fact that she's a woman, and now, you know, Michelle, of course, has to deal with the fact that, God forbid, she's black.
Yeah, but it's really important not to make the mistake of confusing what pundits say, what operatives say, what elected officials say, and what the American people think. It's really important not to conflate the two, because if you look at Michelle Obama's poll ratings, popularity ratings in the United States, they're really, really, really high. So all of that stuff that those people who have a dog in this fight bring to the table is nonsense where the average American is concerned.
Really good point. Really good point. One of our audience wants to know your thoughts on Lean In by Sheryl Sandberg.
I think Sheryl's book has been absolutely invaluable, because it's begun a national conversation about feminism again. You know, when I used to give speeches and do Q&As 8-10 years ago and talk about the fact that I am a feminist, that I'm proud to be a feminist, that feminism not only changed my life, but it changed our world for the better, I used to sometimes feel like a voice crying out in a kind of wilderness that either felt like it didn't want to use the word anymore, or felt that we were post-feminist, whatever that means. See, post-feminist is when there's 51 women in the United States Senate, not when there are 20. And so suddenly with Lean In, I was being asked constantly and engaged constantly in conversations about feminism, about where women were today in the workplace, about how much in the workplace was due to what we bring to the table or don't bring to the table, how much was still prevailing sexism or common practice and the like. So I think that she began a national conversation that I think is only to the good, and she's also really begun that conversation in executive suites and workplaces all over the country where it really needs to take place.
I saw some of her ideas being dismissed or parodied or otherwise negated, because it so happens that her book came out at a time of massive and growing economic inequality. And the idea that she was addressing a very specific audience that is so economically above the average American, that she was in fact being as narrow-sighted as everyone else of that particular economic caliber. Do you think there's any legitimacy in that?
Well, first of all, I think I don't want to speak for Sheryl, who I know and really admire and like, but I think that she would argue that some of the qualities that she talks about women bring to the table in Lean In work at the kitchen table as well as in the boardroom. And they work in terms of women in tougher circumstances, but who want more for themselves and their families. That idea of not waiting for someone to confer, but to say, this is what I need, this is what I want, this is how I want to get it. And I think she acknowledges the fact that frequently feminism seems to be a white middle class phenomenon, that it seems to have left a lot of the poorer women in our country behind. But I also think she'd say, and she's quite correct, because when I first read the book in galleys, I said, well, what about the systemic sexism in the, and she said, first of all, I mentioned that, but second of all, that's not what this book is about. And I think a lot of the criticisms of Lean In have been criticizing the book that she did not choose to write, and that either has been written by someone else or will be written by someone else.
Social media, when you were talking about the challenges to feminism and racism inherent to feminism, et cetera, a lot of that's been playing out really interestingly in social media. Black Feminist Twitter hashtag has been fascinating to follow. One of our audience members wants to know what you think about social media, and I noticed that I can't even tell if you have a Twitter account, because there is someone with your name there, but she's never tweeted, and she has the icon of an egg, which means that she hasn't even bothered to put a picture up. So Social media.
So here's the thing. I know my limitations. Two years ago, when Lots of Candles, Plenty of Cake was published, on PubDate, I took over the Random House Twitter feed. That was the idea, to kind of get some attention. So the Random House Twitter feed had the hashtag candles and cake at the end, and then I tweeted all day long. I think I wound up doing like 100 tweets in the 24-hour period. And at the end, our social media person at Random House, Kate Child, said, "Oh, my God, you're natural. They were such great tweets. I've set aside at Anna Quinlan for you." And I said, "That's great, Kate. I'm never doing it again." And she said, "What are you talking about?" She said, "You had such a good time." I said, "It is clearly such a time suck that if I tweeted, I wouldn't write anything." Ditto, they started a Facebook page for me, and I was like, "Okay, guys, here's the deal. I'm going to post on this maybe once a week, maybe less than that. But I can't do it more than that because I can either work on novels or I can be all over social media, but I can't find a way to do both." Having said that, I mean, you know, my husband is on Twitter all the time, and he uses it as his news feed. So we'll be sitting there, you know, watching 60 Minutes, and he'll look at his Twitter account and say, "Oh, my God, X just happened." And so we switched to CNN or MSNBC. So
who has it 2 hours later?
I think it can be incredibly, incredibly useful. I think, you know, it's like any other kind of media. Some of it's really silly. Some of it's really nasty and pernicious, and some of it's really, really useful. I mean, look, when I was a kid growing up, we got two newspapers a day. We got the Philadelphia Inquirer and the Philadelphia Bulletin. And there was one news program on each of three channels on television at dinner time. That was it. Now, I can get news on television anytime, although I don't really need to because I can get a news feed on my computer at any time. And I can get all of the Brit newspapers, which for me, there are two great things about the internet: Brit newspapers and puppies. Okay, that's, you know. So we have a historic opportunity to be well educated by media. Historic. The problem is, for a lot of people, you have to be your own aggregator. You have to know where everything's coming from. If every day you're going to read the New York Times editorial page, you probably every day should read the Wall Street Journal editorial page. If you're going to watch MSNBC all the time, and Lord knows I do, every once in a while you should watch Fox, because you ought to know what's going on out there from all sides of the spectrum. But if you do the work, or do some of the work, boy, can you be well informed today. And that's just, for somebody like me, who's an information junkie, that's spectacular.
Not cat videos.
Cat videos don't, first of all, I mean, I happen to have two cats, and like all cats, they have contempt for me. You know, puppies on the internet, even through the screen, they're like, "They love me. They're glad to see me." So
I want to acknowledge how much more impact you had with everything else you said there, but I was stuck back on the puppy videos. Someone would like to know how you set the stage for writing, how you structure your days. How often do you write?
I get up pretty early in the morning, and I have breakfast with my husband, and I read four newspapers. Then after I've like digested my food a little bit, I power walk usually for about an hour. And that looks like I'm exercising, but in most cases I'm also working, because especially before I've actually started a novel, I spend an enormous amount of time thinking about it, developing the character, thinking about what she looks like, thinking about, you know, I see people while I'm power walking, and I think, oh, you know, maybe something like that. And I start to think about birth order and job and all that kind of stuff. So a lot of writing goes on when it looks like, you know, you're power walking or making stew or something like that. And then when I get back to the house, I talk to Janet on the telephone most mornings, usually for about a half an hour or so, about this and that, about what she's reading, about what I'm reading, about what our kids are doing, about what we bought online that we now need to return. And then I run out of stuff to do. And when I run out of stuff to do, I go up to the fifth floor, which is where my office is, and that's when I start to write. You know, I do a few more things up there, you know, I shred mail. And I have a series of rituals designed to allow me not to write. But at a certain point, usually between, it's usually around 9:30. After Quinn is writing a novel on the first floor in his boyhood bedroom where he doesn't live anymore, I'm writing a novel on the fifth floor. I work usually from 9:30 or 10 till about noon or 12:30, and then we meet on the second floor in the dining room and have lunch, and then we both go back. And I'm usually done the novel by that time, because after about 2 or 3 hours, my imagination starts to fade. When I was working on a column, I could write for 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 hours, especially if I needed to, if I was on a tight deadline. But with a novel, the pictures in your mind start to go, and there's no point. And so frequently in the afternoon, I'll work on a speech or an introduction to a book I've agreed to do or something like that. And then I knock off usually about 4 or 4:30. Or something.
Have you ever suffered genuine and deep writer's block?
No. I kind of don't believe in writer's block. I mean, I think from being a reporter all those years, I think writer's block is because you fear not being able to write well. And if you've been a reporter, you know that there are days when you write well and days when you write adequately, and a few, hopefully a blessed few days when you write pretty poorly. So I always just sit down and try to do it, because experience now tells me that there are days where I start out writing pretty poorly, and eventually it gets better and better until I'm writing well. And then all I have to go do is go back and delete the rotten stuff. But, you know, if you don't sit down in the first place, I mean, I've quoted it so many times, but I can't stop. Madeline Longla, who wrote A Wrinkle in Time, once said, inspiration comes during writing, not before it. And so if you wait, nothing happens. You know, and it may be that you sit down and everything has to be deleted, but maybe at the very end you got an idea that will kickstart you into the next day.
Question for the fans of your book, Blessings. Our visitor says, I found Blessings very moving at surprising moments, especially the young man's comment at the end. I don't want to give anything away, where he says, it was all good. This said so much in a few words. Was that personal for you from your own life?
Him saying that?
His summation of things with that.
Well, First of all, I sort of feel that way. I tend to be a pretty optimistic person. But that's also an expression that all three of my kids have used at various times over the years. So I probably picked it up from them.
Have you read 50 Shades of Grey or Discovery of Witches? And I love the P.S. What did you really think?
You know what? I'm not going to go there because not because I'm afraid to admit that I read porn. I mean, here's how I feel about porn. Most porn is pretty badly written, but if it's salacious porn, I can forgive it the bad writing. Or if it's well written, I can forgive it not being salacious. But if it's badly written and bad porn, I can't forgive it anything. Having said all of that, I don't write reviews anymore. There was a period in my life where I would be asked by the Times Book Review to review books, and I would do it. And I don't anymore, because I realize, you know, I'm a thoughtful and pretty deft writer, and in 3 or 4 hours, I can eviscerate the work of 3 or 4 years. and I'm not interested in slagging off other writers. I'm just not. I mean, I know it's providing a service for the consumer, but I figure my service to the consumer is that I write my own novels. So I'm not into slagging off other writers, and so I'm going to pass on that one.
Do reviewers have diminishing power now? Because you can go to Amazon or Abe Books and see reviewers of thousands of readers who might have similar profiles to you. So you have some idea, you know, what value that book would have for you. It might be yet another arena in the media where this multitude of voices is diminishing the power of the single voice.
Oh, honey, when you get a positive review in the New York Times, your sales numbers soar. There's no question that it still has. There are just places that sell your book. A good Times review will really sell your book. Being on Fresh Air with Terry Gross will really sell your book. I think probably the biggest difference now is there used to be TV venues that would really sell your book, and that's not so true as it used to be, in part because the morning shows very rarely showcase books anymore. I guess Jon Stewart... Mm-hmm. Can really sell your book, particularly if it's a great nonfiction book. I'm really happy that my friend Betsy Colbert's great science book, The Sixth Extinction, has gone way up to the top of the bestseller lists. But there still are certain things where, you know, you're number 368 in the morning and that Times review hits, and you're number 7 by the end of the day.
Another listener question. When your novels are developed into movie or TV projects, how involved are you in the process?
I'm not very involved at all. I sort of think I'm the worst possible person to advise people as to how to make a film version, because I imagined this in the way that's most suitable for me. And if they're doing it right, they're going to have to reimagine it. I mean, some of the worst movies ever made out of books are ones that adhere slavishly to the way the book was written. It's a completely different form. Having said that, everybody who's been involved in those projects has been fantastic about keeping me in the loop. I got along with so many of them. I just had lunch in L.A. with a screenwriter who wrote the screenplay to One True Thing, Karen Kroner, who just did such a fantastic job. So I have nothing to complain about. And by the way, I think most writers who complain about screen adaptation are big babies, because nobody forces you to do this. They give you, like, a check. You do not need to take the check. So, I mean, if you're going to do it, you need to realize that even for people who are powerful in the business, making a movie is not anything that any one person has control over. I mean, the director may make the director's cut he wants and the studio wants it recut. The actress may sign on with a screenplay she loves and the screenplay gets rewritten. So there's a lot of moving parts. And all you hope is that the people involved are true to the spirit of the piece. And in all three cases, for me, that's been true.
Do you recall the mental process, the inner dialogue you went through with yourself, deciding whether something of yours could appropriately be turned into TV or movie? Or did you just say, I'll take the check?
No, when the producer came to me, when the producer came to my agent to make a deal for One True Thing, he asked to meet with me. And what resonated for him about the novel and how he saw it as a movie was so utterly faithful to the spirit of the novel that I had no hesitation. And each step of the way, you know, when he got Karen involved and we talked about the material, when he called me, his name is Harry Uplin, Harry calls me one day, because what happens with movies is, you know, they option it and then you don't hear anything for the longest time, and then one day they say, hey, we're in pre-production, and you're like, okay. But Harry called me one day and he said, what would you think of Meryl Streep for Kate Golden? And I said, Harry, are there people who go, nah, not Meryl Streep? let's get somebody else, you know? I mean, when he hired Meryl and then Renee Zellweger and then William Hurt, you just, you know, when those dominoes start to fall, you just know that you've made the right decision.
When you were speaking to a gathering of medical professionals in November, there was one phrase in what you had to say that really struck out to me, and that was acknowledge uncertainty. Two things about that. One is, I know that if you are in the sciences, that's a very hard thing to do. I was married to a scientist for years who couldn't say, I don't know. He had to say, it's not clear. And I know that that was a matter of the profession. It was true throughout his profession. But it's also, it strikes me, there's less and less public support for people who will stand up and say, I don't know. I don't have an opinion on that. I don't know enough. We all have opinions. We all have multiple menus to blast them out in. And those of us who say, I am at sea with this, maybe get less public support to do so. Is that your experience, and is that why you felt you had to tell people that?
No, again, let's parse out a little bit. There's, if you read the comments on the internet, you would think that there is no uncertainty in the world. Because, for example, you have an entire camp that's absolutely sure that Woody Allen is actually a right guy who never did anything, even though they've never met him and know nothing about the facts of this particular case. And then there is another camp that's absolutely sure that Dylan Farrow is telling the truth about the abuse that she says was inflicted on her. None of these are people who really know anything about the fact of this matter. So informed opinion is unnecessary. It's just strong opinion. That's what you get all over the internet. But if you're talking to an audience like this one, what you find is that people really appreciate somebody who's willing to say, I don't know, or I don't have an opinion about that. That there has become this split between our virtual selves, which is writ large on television, in social media, in punditry, and our private selves that sits at the kitchen table and says, wow, I'm having a hard time figuring this one out. The reason I said that to the medical professionals I was talking to, because I was talking at the Association of Medical Colleges, they have a lecture every year about patient care, and this was the first year that they decided to ask a patient rather than a physician to deliver that lecture, and I was the patient. I was there speaking on behalf of patients everywhere. Is because, first of all, we know that you don't know. We know that there are things that happen in the human body that are mysterious. And second of all, medical professionals are so tired of people coming in and saying, well, but I just read on mayoclinic.com that it may be that I have Parkinson's or Crohn's disease or something. And I said to the doctors and the medical students, that's because this is the ultimate situation of power and control. And they're trying to take some of the power and control back. And you have to honor that wish on the part of patients. And if you don't want them to take it back by self-diagnosing on the internet, then you need to give it back to them in your office. And one way to give it back to them is when you genuinely are not certain of a diagnosis to say, I'm not sure of this. You need to acknowledge that uncertainty, that certainty.
A number of people in the audience want to know roughly the same thing, and that is about, you know, starting out today, starting out either as a nonfiction writer, starting out as an aspiring young journalist. And your beginnings, you attribute affirmative action. You give that some credit for getting your start in the newspaper job.
Absolutely.
Because after the landmark case, they were looking to hire women, and there you were.
Right.
That's not the case anymore. A lot has changed. What do you advise now for someone looking to get into journalism?
Well, first of all, I'd argue it's still the case at some level. I mean, the fact that there's only two female columnists on the op-ed page of the New York Times is unconscionable. I mean, the op-ed page of the New York Times should look like America. And with all due deference to some of my former colleagues, the pundit class in this country is too white, too gray, too old, and too male. There ought to be younger people, and there ought to be people who reflect the ethnic and racial diversity of this country. But what I would say, and it comes up all the time, and it's so great. So young people come up to me, colleges, and there's two kinds. One kind say, you know, I can't decide whether to be a reporter or to go to law school. And to those people, I say, you should go to law school. Because being a reporter is a really low-paying, still low-prestige, high-grunge profession. But there's some who come up to me and say, Ms. Quinlan, my whole life, all I've wanted to be is a newspaper reporter. And I say, you sit down right next to me because we got a lot to talk about. And the truth is those kids find jobs because there are still small and mid-size and large dailies all over America that if you try hard enough are hiring people. Now, sometimes somebody, I really want to work for the New York Times. And I say, okay, first of all, that almost never happens right out of the gate. If it does happen, you're going to work as a copy kid first. If you work as a copy kid first, what may be the danger is that they'll never see you as anything more than a copy kid. I mean, Susan Faludi was a clerk at the New York Times. And at a certain level, I think there were people at the paper who could never see her as more than a clerk. So that when she wrote the pivotal book about second wave feminism and the reaction to it, backlash, some of those people went, whoa, Faludi is really something. Well, I could have told them that. But I think, you know, the kids who say, okay, I'm going to go to Billings, Montana. I'm going to go to, you know, Woodbridge, New Jersey. I'm going to try Providence, Rhode Island, but if Providence doesn't pan out, I'm going to go to Worcester, Massachusetts. You know, I'm going to importune every editor on the face of God's green earth and try to get that newspaper job. A lot of them find that newspaper job, but you gotta beat the bushes.
We're down to our last question.
Okay.
You act in people's minds as an inspiration, as a wise woman, as a mentor. People give you a lot of respect. When I was looking at old discussions to prepare this, I found your speech to the Mount Holyoke graduating class, and that spoke to me, and I downloaded it for my own use later. And now you have a book out about a woman who's in transition and the grasping change in life, and that's going to speak to a lot of people. So I want to know how everyone's respect for you, the respect of so many people, and them looking to you for wisdom and hanging on what you say, how does that play out in your life? What does that feel like?
I don't feel it most of the time. Most of the time, I'm sitting in front of a blank computer screen in a room by myself trying to figure out what to make for dinner. So, like, I mean, the good thing is, I think one of the reasons why I've been able to speak to women is because I'm a really typical wife, mother, professional, friend in most ways that count. When I do a book tour like this or I go to give a speech, I do get some sense of that. It's incredibly humbling. It's incredibly humbling. But it also makes me think about the very most important thing about reading to my mind, and that is that it makes us feel less alone. That it makes us feel connected to other people, and it makes us understand that we're not the only person on the planet who is having this feeling or that thought or that disappointment. And to be part of that conversation, that makes me feel that way too. I mean, when someone says, you know, when you were writing about your kids, I felt like you were writing about my kids. I sort of intuited that closed loop when I was doing it, and it made me feel as though the world was filled with women stuck in a house with two babies under the age of two. And I feel that same way again. I was in an event when I published this memoir, Lots of Candles, Plenty of Cake, about getting older. I was in an event in New Hampshire, and I looked up, and there were these three great-looking women standing in front of me, and the one said, "We just want you to know, if you think 60 is good, 70 is fantastic." And to have that has just been an enormous gift, and I never see it as anything less than that.
That's great. Well, that brings us to the end. I have to thank you so much. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Angie. You're a great interview. Thank you.
See, the joy of being in the live audience is you get to see me run for the gavel, which is not going to go out over the radio, but I do hope you all enjoyed this afternoon's program brought to you by the Commonwealth Club Silicon Valley, and we would like to thank Anna Quinlan, author of Still Life with Breadcrumbs, our audience here in Palo Alto, and those of you joining us on the radio. And now, this meeting of the Commonwealth Club, celebrating over 100 years of enlightened discussion, is adjourned.